Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hi, this is Josh Levine, and this is Slate's sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen, for the week of September 24th, 2018. On this week's show, Jim Newell will be here to discuss Tiger Woods' first win back after 5 years in the not-winning golf tournament's wilderness. We'll also ask Sports Illustrated's longtime lead basketball writer Lee Jenkins why he took a job as the Los Angeles Clippers Executive Director of Research and Identity, and also what an Executive Director of Research and Identity is supposed to do anyway. Finally, Jonathan Haack will join us to talk about his new documentary, 14 Back, about the Red Sox, the Yankees, Bucky Dent, and their one-game playoff to decide the 1978 season. Joining me in our Washington, D.C. studio is Stefan Fatsis, author of the books Word Freak and A Few Seconds of Panic. Hello, Stefan.
Hello, Josh.
You're excited about this Yankees situation?
Anything to relive my childhood, yes.
All right, we will relive your childhood in but a few minutes. But first, let's talk golf. On Sunday in Atlanta, Tiger Woods won the Tour Championship by 2 shots over Billy Horschel. It was his first tournament victory in 1,876 days. That is a lot of days. Let's listen to what he said right after he made the last putt on the 18th green.
I just can't believe I pulled this off after, you know, what the season's gone through. And
just wanted to let that acclamation wash over us. What he's gone through includes 4 back surgeries and a lot of doubt, including from himself, that he could ever play golf again, much less play at a high level and beat guys like Rory McIlroy and Justin Rose.
And Jim Horschel.
Even Billy Horschel.
Billy Horschel.
Actually the guy he beat. Joining us now to discuss is Slate politics and golf writer Jim Newell. Hello, Jim.
Hi.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I had a great weekend.
I was not expecting it to, this was a great sports moment. I think we will all acknowledge that and not be cynical. But you heard the emotion in Mr. Woods's voice. It felt emotional in a way that I hadn't been expecting. And I think that's because of the scene around 18 where the gallery, the fans just kind of stormed the green and followed him. And it was like a very literal enactment of everything that Tiger Woods has done for this sport. Just like people just rushing in a way that we didn't see when Tiger was out of the game. And Tiger's back, fans are back. It feels great.
Yeah, I don't know if Tiger got advance notice that they were actually going to let everyone behind him, because it seemed like he was trying to hot foot it a little bit past everyone.
That's not a normal thing that
they
happens.
They do it. I mean, I think they do it every year, or usually at the British Open, but they don't do it at most tournaments. But I mean, it was really cool that they did.
Well, at most tournaments, you'd have 100 people sort of slowly walking up the fairway,
right,
as opposed to 5,000.
Right. If it's Brooks Koepka, you'd have 7 people,
right.
Maybe.
Pretending to be excited. But they had the bird's eye cam, and you could just see the like crowd.
It was like scary.
Massing.
It was a little scary.
You were afraid for Tiger.
It was. Well, there were like two cops there protecting him, and they seemed like they really had their hands full.
But he felt emotional. I'm just curious, like, you're somebody who has been rooting for this. You wrote a piece that we published before the Tour Championship about when is Tiger Woods ever going to win? Is it going to ever happen? Perfect timing. But you're somebody who was wanting this to happen, rooting for this to happen. Like, how did it feel to you to finally see Tiger winning again?
I was just very happy afterwards. I don't know. I wasn't screaming or crying or anything, as I thought I might actually be. But I was just very, very happy. And it was wonderful how boring it felt for most of yesterday. It sort of reminded me of when he was at his peak, how boring the Sundays were with him, because he would just have the lead and not let anyone get close to it. And that was just a very pleasant feeling throughout the day. There are a couple of, he had a couple of bad holes, I think 15 and 16, where it looked like the nerves might finally be catching up with him a little bit. And then it was, you know, not boring, and I didn't like that feeling. So, you know, it was, I think for me, it was when he made that par putt on 17 about 4 feet. It was like then you could finally relax.
Two-stroke lead
and enjoy
going
it.
Into the last hole.
Well, it's like if you're a fan of a football team, you want them in retrospect. You want them to have won a close and exciting game because that's more memorable. But as you're actually watching the game, you prefer a blowout. Like it's more relaxing in the moment to win 49-0. It feels more like historically gratifying and memorable to win like 21-20 on a last minute Hail Mary.
The exciting day was Saturday when I happened to accidentally turn on the tournament and Tiger was in the process of birdieing 6 of the first 7 holes. And that was nuts. I mean, I emailed both of you. Neither of you responded. I think Jim didn't want to jinx it. And I found myself tweeting pictures of the TV screen that nobody was liking. but it was really kind of amazing. I mean, were you doing an uppercut fist pump a la Tiger when you were watching that?
Yeah, of course I was. Just in my living room. Yeah. Just uppercuts everywhere. Freaking out my cat, you know? Yeah, that was really exciting. It also just the further out ahead he got, you know, in the middle of the tournament, the more nervous I got, because if he then blew it afterwards, it would just be even more painful. I think, you know, going back to what we want out of Tiger, I think it would be, you know, we'll remember if he has victories here afterwards where he does edge it out on the last hole or something against competition. But I think this one, he just needed to get one under his belt. I think, you know, I was just happy that he could put one away, and then we can actually watch the more exciting ones down the road.
Let's put this into some context. I mean, we had this conversation, 2 months ago about Tiger doing well. He did well the last two majors of the season. He's done well since then. So it did feel inevitable in a way. But the back surgeries and what he's overcome, and I mean physically and golfingly and not the personal stuff from earlier, he looked his age. Not the sort of the sculpt of his upper body, which is still Tiger, but, you know, he was wearing a black tee under his red shirt, which looked a little sort of middle-aged daddy. He was schwitzing like crazy.
Yeah.
And I saw this, you're reading into the shit when you're watching athletes on TV, no matter what you do, but it felt like this was a vulnerable middle-aged man doing something really remarkable, playing the best that he could play.
Yeah, and I also, you know, if you look at what he's done in the last few weeks, he sort of has seemed to accept his age a little bit in that he's not trying to hit it as far as the longest players on tour anymore. He seemed like he cut back on his drive a little bit, and he's a lot more accurate now. I mean, yesterday in the first hole, Rory McIlroy hit it like 30 yards past him, which I think maybe earlier in the year might have pissed Tiger off. But I think Tiger's in a good place with his game right now, where he accepts not being the longest, but being, you know, in the top half of distance, and then just being really, really good with his irons. So I think this is a game that, you know, if he's not trying to kill it and he just accepts just putting it in play and then going from there, I mean, he could do this for a pretty long time.
If his back doesn't collapse.
If he doesn't snap in half again, which I fully expect to happen, but with no medical reasoning. But
do you think the key moment of this season for him, and I'm going to like get this wrong and I'll allow Jim to make fun of me, is it seemed like for the first half of the year, maybe in the first 2/3 of the year, he was driving the ball extremely inaccurately. And it just seemed like an innate part of his game. Like, he never was drove the ball the straightest of anyone on tour, but this was just ridiculous. Like, he wasn't hitting any fairways. Like, even was in the final round of the PGA when he shot that 64, he was didn't hit any fairways on the front nine of the final round. But it seemed like he just made like a small equipment change, and now he just drives the ball straight. Was it really as simple as an equipment change? Was it the notion that you said, where it's like he was just trying to hit the ball too far before? And do you agree that that was the like key to this like well-rounded player that we're seeing now?
Yeah, well, I think he put a new club head on that had a little bit more loft, which, you know, doesn't encourage as much spraying out left, either to the left or right. So I think that helped. But yeah, he also, you know, he said when I went up there for the tournament a couple weeks ago, he was saying this new swing and this new, he put a new shaft on it too, allows him to swing less hard and get similar, if a little bit less distance. So, I mean, that was really all it was. If you, you know, the first few playoff events, he was putting in play, but then he wasn't making any putts. Now he made putts and, you know, he had an easy win.
Yeah. Let's talk about Jim's piece, Stefan, that he wrote from the BMW Championship outside Philly a couple weeks ago. We sent you there because we wanted just like a close-up perspective of this comeback attempt, which was not successful up to that point. But I thought the best stuff, the most interesting stuff, was like you get to be inside the ropes this tournament. I think maybe people don't appreciate that who aren't familiar with how like golf media works. But like if you're credentialed, you get to like stand really close to these guys and really like hear them and see them and also see and hear the crowd and have this really fantastic perspective. Like, what do you feel like you were able to glean from that you hadn't been able to see on television?
Just from a technical perspective, is just watching the flight of the shots. I mean, it was just amazing how they all have these like perfectly maximized ball flights and their drives. Like, they all go up the same amount almost and then fall. It's just like, there's a lot of testing that's gone into getting it there. But also, you know, from a fan perspective, just the amount of crap Tiger is hearing the entire round, just, I mean, every single shout. And then you think that he's been doing this for 20 years and it's been like this for 20 years. Like, it's just, you know, sometimes you would hear a lone voice say something and wonder how he doesn't acknowledge it. It's because he has a lot of practice just ignoring that entirely. And yet at the same point, recognizing that, like, this is fueling him somehow, all of this energy, seeing him come back at 42. Like, he's channeling all of this, even if he's not acknowledging it all while he's playing.
Which raises the question that I think surrounds Tiger and always has, which is, beyond the greatness, why are we attracted to him? I mean, why do you like him? Why do we still want to see him succeed despite the personal life dumpster fires and the surgeries? And the fact that, hey, this was a great athlete who did amazing things in his 20s and 30s, better than probably any athlete in an individual sport ever. And that's captivating on its own, obviously. And then there's the mix of who Tiger Woods is and how he was raised. But why do you think that endures? Why is Tiger at 42 trying to come back such a great story?
I mean, for at least someone my age, in my early 30s, I want him to come back and be the same for pathetic sentimental reasons, you know? But also, I just feel like we got, you know, he was on pace to break every single record. At, you know, he was almost at them by 32 or 33 years old. And then we just had this series of mishaps, you know, personal, physical, everything, that just seems like it cut it off. And now we're you know, hoping that he can come back and resume where he left off, you know, almost a decade ago. So I think people feel like you know, much of it of his own making, but a lot of it just unfair by history standards, what's happened to him in the last 10 years, and want to see if he can get back to where he was.
Somebody tweeted out, it was one of the like official accounts, whether it was the PGA Tour or somebody else, this list of Tiger's 80 wins in really small type to fit in the to fit in like the image field and Twitter. And they were arrayed in three different columns, 27 in the first column, 27 in the second, and 26 in the third. And the first column is like 1996 through 2001. Then the second column is like, I might be getting this a little bit wrong, but it's like it took him 5 years and 5 years to get the first like 27-27. And then there's like they start piling up again. And then there's just like nothing between 2013 and 2018 after this like huge long list of titles and tiny type. And as Jim was saying, it just feels wrong. Like it feels like we were robbed of seeing what we were supposed to see. And it's just like the most stark example of how in sports nothing is guaranteed, and you have to you know, stay healthy. You have to go out and actually win these tournaments. Then there is an inevitability to his victories that we're just now realizing wasn't inevitable. And I think in retrospect, it makes you appreciate what he did even more. And the thing that I thought was really cool about your piece is like noting how little he has to give us in order for us to feel something towards him and feel the humanity, just because back then he gave absolutely nothing. He was a total, he was a dick and nobody cared. And we
but
all loved him.
He gave so much athletically.
He did. That's true. And that's true. And that's a great point that you made about everything that he had to put up with. And for us to even ask anything of him seems a little bit selfish in some sense, but like, just acknowledging children now, or like giving somebody like a fist bump.
The occasional acknowledgement of a child.
Yeah.
Everybody is like, he is like a saint. He's like, we do not deserve his kindness.
Well, I think it's more also, Jim, that he seems to be more grown up. I mean, he obviously had a wife and a kid and two kids whom he, you know, has custody with now with his ex-wife. But now he seems more like a grown up. His entourage is minimal. John Branch did a similar thing that you did for the New York Times following Tiger around for a few days. And the one thing that leapt out at me that I didn't really know was that he's got a very small group now. He doesn't have coaches. He's his own coach. He doesn't have a masseuse or a trainer following him around.
He should probably have a masseuse.
He probably does that at home.
I think he can probably find a masseuse.
Probably find
a
masseuse somewhere. Yeah. I think he can afford masseuse, the
I
best
think
masseuse
so, yeah.
in whatever city they're playing in. But just the notion that he does seem to be scaled back. He has a live-in girlfriend now. He like keeps his sort of professional contacts to two or three people, an agent and a manager. And it seems like a sort of a much more like human scale for one of the greatest athletes of our time.
Yeah, I mean, he probably also, the flip side of that could be they still doesn't trust that many people.
Sure.
But it may have been that, you know.
Which might be smart, too.
Yeah, it may be. I mean, there are probably a lot of people trying to take advantage of him over the years. But I do think that he seems, you know, more grounded. I think he's, like I said in my piece, I think he's humbled just that he's still here. And I think he, you know, I think he's humbled that he recognizes how good the talent is that's come after him. And he can't just sort of get away with acting like he's going to return to this dominant position again. So I think he's just appreciating it as it goes along. We'll see if he can start rattling off more wins, if he reverts to old habits and is a jerk again. But, I mean, this was just a really great year. I don't know how different he is, but as I said in my piece, he plays being a different person very well.
Well, I think publicly we also like to see superstars humbled,
yeah,
and see how they respond to it, and that's
right.
Certainly,
I would have been okay
here.
With him being humbled by one back surgery. Like the other three, I didn't really need personally. Do you ever fantasize about, you know, how he calls like Steve Sands Sansy, Justin Rose Rosie? Do you think about him calling you Newly? Has that ever?
I don't know if he. I think he would probably go with Jimmy, which is very, you know. Not very interesting.
Mm-hmm. No, not at all.
But I don't know. I mean, I went to one tournament. I was inside the ropes, and we're best friends now. but he hasn't given me a nickname yet.
So Ryder Cup is this coming weekend. They're off to France. Our American
heroes.
Phil Mickelson is on the team, even though he sucks. I think Tiger beat
him. Even though he can no longer play golf.
Tiger beat him by 24 shots.
Hey, but they're going to have a made-for-TV match play event.
They are.
I'm tuning in. How much do I have to pay for that, Jim?
I think it's $25.
Wow.
I don't think even I'm going to pay for that. And I'm an insane person, so.
but the Ryder Cup, it's like, it feels like now that Tiger won, golf is just kind of over. Is that wrong? we should still be excited about the Ryder Cup, maybe?
I feel like we don't even deserve the most hyped Ryder Cup now because we just had so much yesterday. But it is going to be, I think people in a couple of days will be ready for it. It's going to be pretty crazy. I don't know if anyone's, besides like Tiger Woods, I don't know if anyone's going to play well at it. I mean, it was something like looking at the field, the Tour Championship, like half the American team was in the bottom, you know, 10 of the field or something. Like Brooks Koepka was a nightmare.
Maybe they were just practicing. Maybe they're actually
maybe they
playing,
didn't care. I
maybe they're playing the other course just mentally to get ready.
Maybe. I mean, maybe they were just, you know, maybe they were setting up the narrative. You know?
They were tanking.
They all played so bad just so that they could be good.
Or tanking so the Tiger could have his win. And that would lift the whole Ryder Cup team.
It was rigged. That's
true.
Yeah. Well, last thought is just that, you know, the other players that are in the sport now because of Tiger, I think he acknowledged or said, just being kind of touched by how they all like greeted him, whether, you know, Ricky Fowler and the likes of those guys after the tournament. And then just like on social media afterwards, everybody just seems like so grateful for everything that Tiger has done for the sport. The fact that there is this like $10 million purse in the FedEx Cup, that's probably because of Tiger Woods. And just all of his like peers basically saying, thank you. It feels like good to them to like lose to this guy and to have the like, you know, him be back on top.
My last thought, the redemption or rehabilitation of Tiger Woods, does it need to take a really sort of another really progressive turn? He's always been a very apolitical person. He's designing a Trump golf course in Dubai.
We forgot to mention the Trump tweet.
Yeah, Trump tweeted during the tournament on Sunday to congratulate Tiger about how great he was playing. When John Branch, in that New York Times story, asked a few anodyne questions of Tiger about Trump and race relations, and Tiger completely punted on answering them. And then Trump tweeted the fake news media worked hard to get Tiger Woods to say something that he didn't want to say. Tiger wouldn't play the game. He's very smart. More importantly, he's playing great golf again, exclamation point. I mean, the redemption would be complete in my mind if Tiger said, no, Donald Trump is full of shit. And I, you know,
I
don't believe that. That's not who I wasn't not playing. The
I'm
game.
Just like so happy to like not in any way tie together golf and politics.
And politics?
Like I just
because golf and politics
he can
never
wear like
be tied together.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, just
there's
I mean, like
nothing political about golf.
Right. But I mean, just I don't know. Maybe I should, but I really don't care what Tiger says about Donald Trump. You know, he could wear a MAGA hat.
Yeah, but
whatever.
Come on. Really? He could wear a MAGA hat? I mean, wouldn't
make you
feel better if he actually stood up and
said
it?
No, it wouldn't make me feel better.
Make
I completely
feel better.
Separate
care.
It from my
That's
day
amazing.
Job.
How do you do that?
Because it's my day job. I don't know. I don't like to have it invade every aspect of what I do.
That's healthy.
Jim is like one of these Fox Sports guys who's like, why? They got to get the politics out of our sports. We gotta stop these guys from having opinions.
Stick to golf.
He wants Tiger to shut up and dribble, is what he's saying.
And by dribble, you mean dribble the ball on like the face of his putting, his sandwich.
I don't think Tiger really wants to get involved in politics.
He just wants Tiger.
I think
to,
that he's made that.
He just wants
clear.
Tiger to be happy. Jim Newell writes about golf for Slate. He also writes about politics,
but not at
but
the
never,
same time.
Not
never
at the
together.
Same time. Never.
Jim, thank you very much and congratulations.
Okay, thank you.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Before we get to our interview with Lee Jenkins, I want to let you know that in our bonus segment for Slate Plus members, we're going to talk about whether a bettor should get paid off after he took advantage of a sports book to the tune of $82,000. We'll tell you more. We'll adjudicate. Gambling will be discussed. To hear that conversation, join Slate Plus. It's just $35 for the first year. You can sign up at slate.com/hangupplus. Back in July, LeBron James announced that he was leaving Cleveland and signing with the Los Angeles Lakers. 2 months later, Lee Jenkins, who wrote the piece for Sports Illustrated announcing LeBron was going to Cleveland, announced he was going to the Los Angeles Clippers to become the franchise's executive director of research and identity. We have Lee Jenkins on the line with us now. Lee, I think it would be fair to say that the Lakers got the better part of that deal basketball wise. Although, hopefully the Clippers got the better. Hopefully the Clippers got the better journalist.
Yeah, although anybody who watches Uninterrupted may beg to differ. But no, I think that's a pretty accurate assessment.
So you were at SI for more than a decade. You were the lead basketball writer for, I believe, 8 years. When I saw this announcement, I was surprised, less because it clearly seems interesting, like, and it seems like a cool move. It's just not something that was particularly precedented or something that I was anticipating. So can you just give us a little bit of background on how this happened and why you made this move?
You know, when you're covering people, I've covered the Clippers, covered the whole league. You know, you sort of meet people as you go, and there are some people you connect with and, some, frankly, you don't. And late in the regular season, I had lunch, and I didn't know Michael Winger. He's the general manager of the Clippers. It was just kind of a getting-to-know-you lunch. He was new in town. It's kind of what you do sometimes. I mean, I live in Los Angeles, and you're trying to kind of develop sources wherever you can. And we had lunch. It was a few hours. And this never came up, we really didn't talk all that much even about basketball. But a couple weeks later, he called back and, wanted me to come into the office and talk. And we did talk more about basketball. And he broached for the first time taking sort of my skills, taking reporting skills, different style of asking questions, different style of putting together information. And he asked me if I ever thought that could be valuable to an organization or if that's something that ever interested me. And honestly, I'd never in my life even thought about that. In the 8 years I've done this, nobody from the NBA had ever asked me anything like that. I didn't think it would ever come around again. And I was interested in it.
I want to go to one of the first things you said in that answer, which was that, you get all this information as a journalist, but I think the most self-aware reporters understand that you're never quite sure that you have the full story. There's always the knowledge that there's more there. And for me, that was the impetus to do immersive participatory journalism. I mean,
yep.
I know that I learned more about the NFL from being inside it for a short time than I ever learned from covering it. But I also knew that I was there to write a book about it and that with any luck, a lot of people might read that and see my name on the cover. And wow, lucky me. You're not doing this to write a book, obviously. This is a career change and maybe it's temporary and I assume it's for more money than a journalist can make. But do you worry about knowing so much and not being able to share it with the public the way you have? This is going to be a different approach to work.
I mean, even just now through the process, I mean, I've learned things that I never could have imagined. And there are moments I'm like, God, that would be great. Like, this would be a great story. But you have to you have to divorce yourself from that. And I do believe that it will inform my perspective and the way because pro sports, it's never forever. I fully expect to write again at some point in my career, be back in the media. And I think can I share all of this? Probably not, but I'll for sure be more informed.
One of the things that struck me as I was thinking about what you're going to be doing that seems like a very fundamental challenge is in determining the difference between how players respond to a journalist writing about them versus how they respond to a team executive trying to decide whether to hire them. Who are they more likely to open up to? How are they likely to open up and in what different ways? They're trying to sell themselves in, I think, both situations. But I'm really, again, this is where I wish you could just write about this after you do it for a year so that we can sort of better understand, how do human behavior in, the media versus employment. Have you started to think about sort of the approach to those kinds of conundrums?
I have, and it may not be, I think it's easy. It's easy to assume, it'll be easier. All the walls will be down. I don't necessarily know that that's the case. I mean, I'm going to have to learn about, the relationships between teams and front offices. And, there's complication there too, just as there is between players and media, players and front offices. So those are all I think, kind of fraught relationships and part of what you hope to do as a journalist and now that I'd hope to do as an executive is to, you know, to build those bridges the best you can, to create, you know, to create connection. That's what we're always trying to do. What I'm trying to do when I interview somebody is, you know, I'm trying to create a relationship, a working right. relationship, but still a relationship and a feeling like this person could trust me and talk to me. And I'm hopeful that I would do the same, although I'm not naive enough to think that there would be no challenges. I think there'll be different challenges, but I still think they'll be present.
Do you have a sense, I'm always interested to hear Stefan talk about in the NFL how players kind of can bond over hating the league or hating football in
right.
some sense. Do you have a sense in the NBA of whether there's kind of solidarity among players? I mean, we see it out in the world that players across teams are all friends with each other. But are there kind of bonds that are made kind of because they don't like the GM or because they hate the coach or because I don't have the sense, certainly,
they
that
hate
players,
the director of identity.
I don't.
That's more likely.
I certainly don't have the sense that players hate basketball in the way that they hate football, quite the opposite. But I'm wondering if you've thought through or seen in your years as a reporter kind of how those relationships are formed either within teams or across teams.
Yeah, I think in the NBA right now, relationships are massively important. I mean, some of these friendships among stars, I think, they'll change the landscape of, they change the landscape of the team. They're critical in free agency. I feel like you hear about that a little bit more with coaches, you know, where they'll sort of be a galvanizing. I mean, it's a little old fashioned to me. And I think of some of the more old school coaches where I think that dynamic might exist. And it is kind of a football dynamic, right? Is you're sort of, you're almost bonding against the coach who's the, you know, the Bear Bryant type, the Ditka type. I feel like the modern NBA coach is more in it with his players. You know, I'm thinking about Golden State, or I'm probably not even allowed to talk about other teams anymore, but I think about some of these sort of very modern coaches where there seems to be a real partnership with their players. And I think that's what teams are moving toward. As far as general managers, what I've found is it's really interesting. Some general managers, you know, you can see them embody more the Billy Beane philosophy where they don't have real relationships with the players, that they try to keep them a little bit at a remove for strategic reasons. Whereas others, and I'd almost say most in the NBA, probably more than baseball, there is a relationship there. I mean, they want to be down there.
So the name of the game, obviously, in the NBA is acquiring star players.
Right.
There was a report earlier this summer that the Clippers fired their announcer, Bruce Bowen, for saying negative things about Kawhi Leonard. And the reports or the insinuation was that the Clippers were doing that because they wanted Kawhi to potentially sign with them. I presume that you will not want to talk about that specific event, but I'm just curious.
No, I'd love to get fined day one.
No, I'm just curious what I'm just curious kind of what your thoughts are around how your work and your values as a journalist could mesh with the fact that really what the organization is trying to do and what its goal is to get a few star players who we will not name to sign with the team.
No, that's the reality of it. No, it's a complete, and that's where it's a complete change. They already have a lot of competitive players on the roster, but the idea is to make the Clippers a team that has traditionally not been a destination into a destination. And that drives a lot of what the organization is trying to do every day. And I think they've already done it to some degree because, I mean, they play in LA. They've played in LA for a long time, but they're owned by Steve Ballmer. They're owned by the wealthiest owner in pro sports and, you know, maybe the most committed or one of them for sure. So there's no doubt that the goal changes. It's no longer to, you know, tell the sorts of stories that I told before. It's to help them build what could be an epic sports story.
When you did your really famous and well done I'm Coming Home story with LeBron, obviously you've written so many great profiles over the years, but this was one that was written literally in LeBron's voice.
Right.
I'm curious if that experience, if you feel like that kind of analogizes in any way with what you're doing now. And also, how did you, as you're kind of listening to LeBron tell you his story and why he made his decision, kind of how are you kind of sifting through or deciding whether what he's telling you is, you know, he's being 100% truthful with his kind of experience and what decision he was making?
Yeah, two questions. So I do think part of that, I didn't think about it in those terms, but I do think you're right. I think that there are elements of that where you are, obviously that's his truth, right? That was his truth. It was from his mouth. And my goal
he was presenting it as his truth, certainly.
Right. It was.
And he's given us no, he's given us no reason to disbelieve him. Just to be clear, I'm not saying he was lying, but it's just like he's telling you what he says, and you have you're kind of taking his word for it.
Well, we're making journalistic judgment.
That. I mean, a lot of what I've done has been that. It's I mean, not in first person, and you quote a bunch of other people, and you talk about a bunch of people, and you lend your perspective to it. But at the end of the day, you ask these questions, and you take the answers, and I have no account for always the subjects. What the subject says, the subject's own truth. And so in that case, it was, you know, it was 100% of that. I didn't probably, you know, my goal in that instance was to explain what he was doing and why. And that was that was the point of the interview. That was the point of the piece. Will I be doing some of that in this role? It's possible, but this won't be, I mean, I'm not going to be writing for their website. I'm not going to be, I mean, they already have two great PR guys, Chris Wallace and Dennis Rogers. That won't be the job necessarily. But for sure, in that moment, you're probably more in it with your subject than you would be otherwise, because one of those huge walls is down.
Right.
And they have the control.
You know, Lee, the other thing that we haven't touched on here is what your hiring and what the Clippers' pursuit of you says about where professional sports are heading and the sort of relentless pursuit of something different, a way to gain one more edge. And for most of the last decade, we've been talking about that analytically, and almost all of the writers and reporters that have been hired by front offices have been analytics guys.
John Hollinger being the number one example of a former SI guy who's the GM of the Grizzlies.
Right.
That's part now. And there a lot.
And it seems like, you know, again, this sort of application of ideas from other realms of life and work being dragged in or brought into sports just to find one more edge. I mean, you're conscious of that being the case here, I assume.
I hope so. I hope it helps give them an edge. They're definitely, I mean, they're really
no pressure
people. Yeah, I mean, you know, and it's the kind of thing Ballmer would do. Is he's going to look under every rock. He's going to try to find an edge. He's going to think differently. And so it's not, I guess in that sense, it's not surprising. But I do think part of it is this idea, because I've been around enough organizations and I'll meet people and I'll say, what'd you do before coming here? And I gave this example earlier, but like I was in Oklahoma City once and I asked somebody that. He said, I just got off a submarine. He'd been working on a submarine and then he was going to work with the Oklahoma City Thunder. So it's, people who come from different backgrounds, I think this is something that in all corporate environments, but particularly recently in the NBA, they're trying to get people to look at it differently.
Yeah, and I think in one of your earlier answers, you were kind of suitably just kind of unsure about what kind of effect that you would have there. Because if I went in there as a journalist, I'm somebody who, like you, is kind of racked with uncertainty, as I think a lot of journalists are. I would have no idea if I would be able to predict that or provide something valuable to say how a guy would react after his first contract. I mean, that seems like maybe you could get a hint here or there, but it really seems
On the other
hand, impossible to say.
On the other hand, if you approach it journalistically, as I know you will, Lee, there's a body of social science and research about performance and about psychology and about how people integrate into organizations that you're probably going to end up reading a lot more about than you ever have to try to get an assessment of how people will perform and fit in.
Yeah, and also what you can do as an organization to put them in a best possible position. When you look at their story, you look at your team's story, where do those mesh? Where do they not mesh? Mm-hmm. I think all of those are, my answer for everything with every story, is just to dig, to just find a little bit more, get all this information and you put it together like a puzzle. You say, okay, who do we have here? And it's really hard to tell, okay, this is how we know about this person. This is how they will react to this kind of situation. You probably can't tell that. I mean, you can't tell that for sure. No one can really tell you that. But the information can't hurt. I think you can at least get maybe a little bit closer, to knowing, what's inside, to knowing who a person is than you do otherwise. And I'm not saying they don't do that already. I think these teams do that already. But I do wonder sometimes if it's worth further thought. Like, I'll ask coaches sometimes about this sort of issue about players. And they always say, I wish we knew a little bit more about who they are. And so that's my challenge also in the job I've had, is I want a little bit more about who you are.
Yep.
How do you get that? How do you ask questions that lead you to that? That's the trick, right? If I could sit down with every player I've ever interviewed and say, well, who are you? And they would just talk for the next hour, then the job would be easy. But the fact is, there's so much that goes into trying to figure that out, and then you never figure it out fully anyway. You're just trying to get yourself probably a little bit closer to understanding.
Yeah, my last thought for you is more of a comment, which I've kind of, it's dawned on me as we've been having this conversation, is that success in our field is extremely subjective, whether it's about an individual piece of work or a body of work. But it's at once subjective and almost entirely under your control. Not entirely, but it's largely under your control. With an individual story, you write it, and it's as good as the work that you put into it. And now the role that you're moving into now, your success is the organization's success, which is extremely objective. It's wins and losses and playoffs and championships. But your role as a cog in that will be completely, I think, opaque even to you, probably.
You know, I wish our business was still subjective. I wish that were the case, meaning sports writing business or the media business. But I don't know that it's fully subjective. I feel like they're putting metrics on stories and not really Sports Illustrated. They insulated me from that. But I feel like I hear about that more and more. I do feel like they're using more gauges also. But no, you're right. This is I'm entering a wins and losses business here, and I'm part of a larger team. And fortunately, I'm flanked by people who really know what they're doing. And, when you're a journalist, I think you guys probably feel like this, you're essentially just a professional learner. It's like, throw me into something, I'll try to learn as fast as I can and become kind of an expert in the moment on it and see if I can kind of get myself through it. And I know that, especially in the early stages, that's what I'm going to try to do.
Lee Jenkins was the lead NBA writer for Sports Illustrated. He's now the Los Angeles Clippers Executive Director of Research and Identity. Thank you so much, Lee, and good luck with the new job.
Thanks a lot for having me, guys. Appreciate it.
Can you set the stage a little bit so people understand what happened?
In 1969, 14 black student athletes were kicked off their university's American football team for planning a show of support against racism.
We were really protesting our treatment on the field.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story.
We became brothers that day when you did that to us.
We made a change.
Fighting for what we deserve.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Oh,
On October 2nd, 1978, the Yankees and Red Sox, tied at the end of the regular season, met in a one-game playoff in Fenway Park to decide the American League East Division title. I was 15, and I listened to the game on a transistor radio during JV soccer practice. Coach said it was okay. When Yankee shortstop Bucky Dent hit a three-run homer in the seventh, I ran around the field in rapturous glee. That day was also a life highlight for a guy that I would meet on the first day of college 3 years later, our next guest, the film director Jonathan Hawke. His latest is made basically for the two of us. It's called 14 Back, and it's about the absolutely bonkers 78 season, the Bronx Zoo, Reggie, Billy, and George, 14 games behind in July, the playoff, Bucky fucking Dent. The film is on Sports Illustrated TV, and you should watch it. John, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Stefan. Happy to be back.
Thank you guys for letting me be here, even though the film is just for you two.
Really? Well, you're invited.
All right.
Others
yeah,
are invited
friends
to watch
and
it.
Family. Friends and family are invited.
14 games back is a lot of games to be back. So let's listen to Dan Shaughnessy of the Boston Globe, Carlton Fisk, Fred Lynn, and the spaceman Bill Lee of the Red Sox talk about being that far back.
14 games in July means the season's over, and the Yankees, they were in chaos. So you just stopped kind of paying attention to them.
We thought we might, at the end, 14 games might turn into 24 games.
They're 14 games behind us. They're done. They are done.
We're 14 games ahead. What does that mean? Don't whistle past cemeteries. The dead will rise, and they'll come and get you.
I wrote a faux memoir about the game for Pesca's recent book of What Ifs. It's up now on Sports Illustrated's website. And John, you've made the definitive documentary about it. How important was this moment to you growing up, and what was it like to take control of it as a filmmaker?
Well, it's probably the single moment I remember better than any other sports moment. Maybe Reggie's third homer at Yankee Stadium the fall before. But this was, you know, I was 14, and it was the pinnacle of my fandom. And it was Rosh Hashanah. So we were, my dad was home from work, and we got back from synagogue and turned on the game like any good assimilated Jewish family would. And what happened over the next 3 hours was, you know, literally the greatest moment of my life. To take control of it as a filmmaker, I don't really look at it as taking control of it. It's sort of the other way around. The moment sort of takes control of you, and the characters in the film take control of you. And as the storyteller, you kind of just get into the flow with your characters and the history you're recounting. And you know, we poured a lot of hours into making this film, but it was kind of effortless the whole way at the same time, because it was just, you know, it was sort of part of my fiber. And Jim Potteritz, co-writer and producer and editor, he was also sort of in the same place at the same moment, the same age. And it was kind of the perfect vehicle for us to just be ourselves as filmmakers and just let ourselves get absorbed into the story. And that's the best way to do it.
It's really great. It is really absorbing, even if you don't care about these teams, which
even
I don't.
Even if you weren't born in 1978.
Yeah, I mean, you guys grew up with all of these guys. You also grew up with this game. But I'm curious what you think of my interpretation of these players in these interviews. Like, they're super engaging, and I really enjoyed watching them. But I felt like if these players were around now and stepping contemporaneously, these guys are all like huge assholes. And the whole, like, just like this whole ethos of playing the game the right way and all the fights they got into around like the proprieties of, you know, this guy did this on the field or this guy did that on the field. This guy's like Greg Nettles and Sparky Lyle. And, you know, Carlton Fisk, and like listening to all these guys talk, just like I found them really hard to like just the way that they talked about the game, and just that they seem like jerks kind of.
Well, I didn't have that impression. I thought they were kind of awesome. And and unfiltered, and you know, they were playing the game at a time when the World Series check was sometimes more than they were making the whole season, and hatred was a virtue. You know, that was sort of a guiding principle of the spirit of this rivalry at the time when they would have fistfights all the time. I mean, Nettles told us a story about the 77 playoff or 78? I think it was game five. So it must have been 77 when there was a fistfight that broke out when George Brett slid into third, and they just immediately started punching each other. It's like a slapstick comedy to watch the old highlights on YouTube. But they broke up the fight, and Marty Springstead was the umpire, and he said, "Listen, you, Brett, you're an important player. I'm not throwing you out of game five. Nettles, you're an important player. I'm not throwing you out of game five, but no more fighting." And that's the way it happened then. And I don't think they're assholes. I just think that they're of a different time. And I think that the intensity with which they can remember the ill will speaks to their, you know, their honesty and how important it all was to them. And I think that if there is something lacking from the game today, certainly skill is not lacking, strength is not lacking. But what is lacking is, what is not there, it may be regrettable to you, it may not be, but what's not there is the real personal animus that can come to exist over the years. I think they're just all too well paid to be enemies with one another anymore. And that's fine for them, and it's fine for us. It's the way it is, but it was kind of cool back then too.
Yeah, I mean, and that really was what the era was like, Josh, especially for the players, but also for the fan bases. I mean, this was sort of genuine hatred. I mean, look, Yankees fans and Red Sox fans in their respective stadiums would brawl throughout basically every game. I mean, as a teenager, John and I both went to Yankee Stadium, and I know my friends and I would count the fights during games because there were usually 15, 18, 20 fights in the stands. And then on the field, this was real dislike. Fisk and Munson brawled first in 1973, 5 years before this season. There was another brawl in 76. Chambliss got hit by a dart that was thrown by a fan in 1974. And the intensity, and I think that's the word you used, John, is what really leapt out at me in the film. There's the one moment where Bill Lee, who's fantastic, he's a quote machine and he always has been, where he pulls Greg Nettles' baseball card out of his wallet, this faded, chipped, falling apart baseball card, and said that Greg Nettles is right next to my right ass cheek for eternity, and the view and the smell don't get any better with time. I mean, this is 40 years ago, and the passion that they brought is still palpable. And I think that's what makes telling the story of this season so powerful, because it really was crazy. And not just in the animus between the two teams, John, but of course in the backstory with the Yankees, which, why don't you set that up, just about how dysfunctional and how insane the 78 season was and 77 preceding it.
Yeah, and it is so much fun to think about. I mean, and Josh, you who deplore the Derek Jeter-ness and the deliberate blandness of pro sports today, I would think might get a kick out of all that. Well, what was going on with the Yankees back then was in 76, they were American League champions. They got swept in the series, but they had overtaken the Red Sox, who were American League champions in 75 and almost won the World Series. Then the Yankees, they have a big fight in Yankee Stadium with the Red Sox, and they end up winning the division and the pennant. Thurman Munson's the league MVP. He's got a very fragile ego. He wants to be considered. He was always had a chip on his shoulder because he thought he was not considered the great player that he was. He was a league MVP. He had three gold gloves at that point early in his career, and he was still sort of considered second fiddle to Carlton Fisk. of the Red Sox, and he it was really important to him to be the man. And then George Steinbrenner goes out without consulting the manager and signed Billy Martin, who was thin-skinned to say the least. He signs Reggie Jackson, the most bodacious, braggadocious, swaggalicious free agent in the history of free agency. And it was actually the first year of real unfettered free agency in baseball. And Reggie immediately calls himself the straw that stirs the drink. A quote that every player on the team remembers with hatred in their voice as they recount it. And Thurman can only stir it bad, and he's the only one who can stir it right. And from that point on, he's got all of his teammates against him. He's got his manager against him, and this causes dissension that is gobbled up by the New York newspapers. The tabloids love it. Rupert Murdoch has just bought the New York Post, so he turns it into this, huge headline, blaring, gossipy scandal sheet. And the Daily News follows suit, and there's a tabloid war. And Reggie and Billy and Thurman feed these insatiable tabloid writers with soap opera story after story, and the guy kind of orchestrating it behind the scenes, it turns out, is George Steinbrenner, who's the biggest leaker in the organization, and he just wants to keep the Yankees in the headlines, and he's having a grand old time. While I think there were more fistfights in the clubhouse than there were on the field between
Munson and Jackson.
Munson and Jackson.
Multiple times.
Can I just stop you guys there? It's like, I'm surprised that you would push back on the idea that these guys are assholes. The Yankees hated each other. All these guys, it wasn't just cross-team animus. They all thought that each other on their own team were assholes. Well, I'm not saying that makes it like, I think it makes it more enjoyable, but I'm just saying like, these guys are...
I don't know. These are like genuine human emotions. Reggie Jackson was a complete asshole. His teammates...
So was Billy Martin. So was George Steinbrenner.
Yes. It was the greatest collection of assholes in the history of sports.
I just think it's important for you guys. You guys are fish. You do not see the water that you're swimming in. Like, fast forward this 40 years. We had a conversation about Goose Gossage talking about how nerds have ruined the game, mm-hmm. and just sounding like all of these guys are total reactionaries. And they all are saying things like that when players say this stuff today, we push back and we fight back against it. And maybe that makes them colorful and fun because they're of a previous generation.
I think that team of Yankees that season, the ownership, management, and some of the players were really, there's really no parallel in baseball history. So I think you either look back on it as, yes, this was crazy, and to graft it into 2018 is impossible. But to look at it in the context of the times, it's weird. I mean, I don't remember as a fan being glad that there was all this turmoil, that like Reggie stormed into the dugout and got into a fight with Billy Martin
entertaining
in 1977.
And engaging.
It was entertaining and engaging. And it really heightened the sense of partisanship as a kid. Like hating the Red Sox was a real thing.
The last thing I'm going to say about the fighting is just that as somebody who grew up a bit later, it's just really hard to watch this and see it celebrated and not think about like Ron Artest and the Malice in the Palace and just how the valence of that was totally different. It was not fun. It was not considered colorful when it was black basketball players doing it. And so that's just kind of the milieu I'm coming from here.
Well, I probably wouldn't share the standard view of the Malice in the Palace. But in any case, how great – tell me something. Would Bill Belichick and Robert Kraft be bigger assholes or less assholes? Would Tom Brady be a bigger asshole or less of an asshole if he was really saying what he felt about, they all were saying what they really felt
about
one another.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So I don't think I mean, Steinbrenner was an asshole. Billy Martin was an asshole. Reggie Jackson was apparently a big asshole. But, you know, that's okay. I don't think the rest of the guys really hated one another. I think they, I mean, Pinella loved his teammates. He cries thinking about them, you know, at the end of his interview, he starts crying and what a great time in their lives. Yeah. And, you know,
and I felt the same thing with Carlton Fisk and the relationship that most of the Red Sox have. Even Jim Rice, who at the time was viewed as, you know, in Boston, African-American superstar that wasn't embraced by the public. Even Jim Rice, you can tell, feels a sense of nostalgia and a sense of community with the players that he went through this with in 1978.
Yeah, what's interesting was that it was the Sox who were known at the time as, the, you know, 25 Cabs for 25 players, that they were the ones who didn't really get along. And what Louis Tiant told me that when, you know, he was on the Red Sox in 78, but he was traded or he left as a free agent and went to the Yankees in 79. And he said, you know, the first 5 months of the season before Thurman Munson was killed in the plane crash, after every game, he and Nettles and Pinella and Thurman and Gossage and Cliff Johnson would go into the sauna with a case of beer. And for 2 hours, they would just talk about baseball. And they wouldn't talk about salaries. They wouldn't talk about their girls. They wouldn't talk about anything but baseball. And Louis said it was his favorite time in his entire career was hanging with those guys and talking baseball because they were really into baseball. And, you know, I was really into baseball then too, and I really loved these guys. But again, not reverentially now. I think that's one of the keys to the film was that we not be reverential about it all. There's some nostalgia to it, of course, but the tone is not reverent. It's there's a lot of laughs. And I think we were following the lead of our characters in that these guys, you know, they were really serious about it at the time, but they're funny about it now.
Let's talk about the game, and the stuff that you have about the Bucky Dent home run is really great and revelatory. But I wanted to ask you about, you know, since that is obviously the thing that everybody knows about from that game, was there a moment that you had forgotten about or something that was really important to the players that kind of surprised you or you think might surprise people who think they know that game?
The pitch before the home run, Bucky fouled the ball off his foot and was rolling around the dirt and looked like he might have to come out of the game. And everybody who watched the game remembers that. It was, you know, the classic, like Bernie Carbo in the 75 series, he foul tips one barely with two strikes to stay alive. Then he hits the home run. Here's Bucky fouling one off his ankle and rolling around the dirt and looking for all intents and purposes like a dead man, and then gets up and hits the homer. While he's rolling around in the dirt and they're spraying the ethyl chloride on his ankle and trying to get him back ready to play, Mike Torres, the pitcher for the Red Sox, was just standing out on the mound waiting, and he had been really locked in. He had given up no runs and two hits through six, and gave up two singles before Bucky Dent. So Butka had two outs and was really, really sharp. And during this time that Dent is trying to get himself back, which was, you know, several minutes, Torres doesn't take any warm-ups. And he just kind of loses his focus and loses his groove. And when he came back to, you know, when play resumed and he threw his first pitch back, it was not nearly as sharp as the pitches he had been throwing all game to that point. And Torres kind of blames himself, and Fisk kind of mused about who's to blame for that? Carlton Fisk, the catcher. You know, they both felt that they had Bucky right where they wanted him.
Because Bucky was a terrible hitter. He was always right where pitchers wanted him.
Yeah, you know, he was the worst hitter on the Yankees and had four home runs all year. And, you know, as long as you didn't throw it over the middle of the plate, waist high, you weren't in trouble with Bucky. And that's exactly what Torres did on the next pitch.
My favorite moment is when Carl Yastrzemski pops up to end the game, but that's just me. Jonathan Hawk is the director of 14 Back and many other fantastic documentaries. He's not an asshole. Neither am I.
But he likes other assholes.
You can watch the film on Sports Illustrated TV. John, thank you so much for talking about our childhoods.
Thank you very much for having a childhood with me.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title the Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now. Now it is time for After Balls. I feel like I should note, I don't know if listeners will have noticed, but I feel like there's some talk of Tiger Woods being a jerk, and the Red Sox and Yankees players being assholes. Mm-hmm. We're celebrating Tiger. But is it kind of... making some digs at the baseball players. Does that seem contradictory? So do I feel like do I seem like a hypocrite?
Your hypocrisies, yes.
The explanation is just that the heart wants what it wants, Stefan. What are we calling our afterballs this week?
I thought that we just listened to John's interview. The most enduring phrase to come out of the Red Sox Yankees playoff game is of course the epithet in New England renaming Bucky Dent as Bucky fucking Dent, or the sanitized Bucky bleeping Dent. Seems obvious, but I thought it must have a source, so I looked for it. The first reference comes just 2 days after the game. It's in the Boston Globe in a postmortem column by the great Peter Gammons. Gammons quotes a friend saying, "I'm not even sure the Yankees are better. When those two teams play, they're on another level, in another world from other teams in sports. There is a brotherhood there, a kind of passionate respect that is what athletics are supposed to be. Problem is, the Yankees finish first and the Red Sox second. Bucky bleeping Dent."
We should ask Peter who the friend was. Congratulate the friend.
Give the friend his proper due after all these years.
I think... Bucky fucking Dent. We can't make that the afterball name.
No, just go Bucky bleeping Dent.
No, the afterball should be, what is your Peter Gammons' friend? We need to give respect where it's due. What is your Peter Gammons' friend, Stefan?
Well, there are two mysteries from that playoff game that have bothered me over the years. Both involve Bucky Dent's bat. Mystery number one, whose bat did Bucky Dent actually use to hit the home run? Let's listen to a clip from 14 Back. We're going to hear from Bucky, then Lou Piniella, Mickey Rivers, and Willie Randolph.
Mickey goes, "Hey, homie, you got the wrong bat."
Bucky fouls that ball off his ankle, and Mickey Rivers tells him, "Listen, use my bat. Use my bat," he says. I got a good feeling.
I say, "Bat boy, go grab the bat out of the hand and give Bucky the bat. Tell him he got a home run in it. I just know that's my homie, so I want him to do good."
Mickey gave him that bat. That other bat, that seemed to have some magic in it.
All right, that's a nice, simple story. Bucky fouled the ball off his foot. Rivers told the bat boy to give Dent one of his bats because it was Wonder Boy. But it doesn't jibe with the historical record. In fact, it doesn't even jibe with Tom Verducci's SI cover story about the game in this week's magazine. Quote, "Light-hitting shortstop Bucky Dent belted a home run with Roy White's bat, which was given to him by Rivers," Verducci writes. All right, I went to the archives to resolve this critical historical discrepancy. Some accounts imply that the new bat was just another bat from Dent's regular stash. Thomas Boswell of the Washington Post, his game story quotes Dent saying that Rivers noticed a crack in Dent's bat and got him another model of the same style bat. The Hartford Courant quoted Dent in the locker room, "Mickey Rivers thought I had the wrong bat. After I fouled the ball off, he yelled over and said, 'It's chipped. You're using the wrong one,' and he gave me another one." All right, the It Was Rivers' Bat faction is mostly retrospective. It includes Pinella in the clip we just heard. Baseball historian Harvey Fromer, Dent borrowed a bat from Rivers. Dave Anderson of the New York Times, Dent's home run off Mike Therese had been struck with one of Mickey Rivers' bats. And Steve Serby of the New York Post, Rivers gave his bat to the Yankee bat boy, who sprinted to the plate and handed it to Dent. 10 years after the game, even Dent told the New York Times, "I'd used Mickey's bats before, so he gave me his." But hold on. In 1999, Mike Lupica wrote in the Daily News, "Legend always had it that the bat Mickey Rivers handed him was one of Rivers' spare bats. Roy White said yesterday that it was one of his." Lupica made it sound like he was breaking the Roy White story, but Newsday's 1978 Gamer reports that Dent had been tired and slumping and, quote, had tried a lighter Roy White model bat before the game and said he liked its feel. Rivers uses the same bat, but the one Bucky was using had a chip in it, Rivers said. Aha, so it was actually a Roy White bat that Rivers used that Dent tried out that day. Mystery solved. Not so fast. There's an even more convoluted version in Will McDonough's game story in the Boston Globe, which, because it's convoluted and it's a string of direct quotes from Mickey Rivers right after the game, I'm going to say is the most reliable. In it, Rivers explains that he and Dent use the same style bat. The bats actually did belong to Roy White, but White didn't use them, so he let us have them, Rivers said. At noon on the day of the game, Rivers asked the Yankees clubby if he had any more of the bats because the one that they, Dent and Rivers, used was a little chipped. The clubby found one of the Max 44 models. Rivers, quote, "taped it up before the game the way we liked it, and I told Bucky I had a new one that felt good. He said he was going to stick with the chipped one. I was on him to change, and he wouldn't. I was even yelling to him from the on-deck circle that I had the bat with me. Finally, when the ball hit his foot and he was being treated, I grabbed the bat boy and told him to take the bat up and take away the one Bucky had." So, everybody is right. It was technically Roy White's bat. He owned it, but he didn't use it at all. You can see in the film that White swung a black bat during the game, not a tan one. So implying that Dent homered with White's bat is kind of misleading. And the bat is also Rivers' bat, because it sounds like Rivers did use it in the game. But Dent and Rivers used the same model. Rivers just used the one with no chip. So it was kind of Dent's bat too. Conclusion, this is the Al Capone's vault of afterballs. But here's mystery number two. Let's listen to a little bit more from 14 back. In order, Luis Tiant, Fred Lynn, and Mickey Rivers.
And they told me they put some cork in the bat. That's what they said. Mickey Rivers told me. Remember Mickey Rivers changed the bat?
Those things happened in those days. I'm not saying that those guys did, but those things did happen.
No, no cork in the bat. Fucking just lucky. Just got lucky. I tell everybody this. Sometimes you got to believe, you know. I was just pulling for my homie.
All right, so cork or no cork? In 1989, Mike Therese, who gave up Dent's homer, agreed to reenact the at-bat at the opening of Bucky Dent's baseball school in Florida. "I'd like to see if the little cheater can hit it out without the corked bat," Therese told the Fort Lauderdale Sun Sentinel. "Mickey told me 2 years ago that Bucky's bat was corked." Dent replied in the story, "The bat wasn't corked. Mickey and I started that rumor." This checks out. A year earlier in 1988, a friend of Dent's brought the bat to the Yankees locker room on Old Timers Day. "There's the bat," Dent said in the aforementioned Dave Anderson column, "the one with the cork in it." Dent went on to explain that during the same event a year earlier, a summer that several hitters were suspected of corking their bats, quote, "Dent and Rivers had joked that the home run bat had been corked. We were just kidding," Dent said, "but some people took us seriously." Dent repeated the story in 2003 in a piece in the Wall Street Journal in which reporter Daniel Golden invited him to watch a game from the new green monster seats. A fan said to Dent, "Come on, it had a little cork in it. So what?" Dent is quoted as replying, laughing. "So what?" Mr. Dent said, laughing. "Me and Mickey started that rumor." Conclusion, Bucky Dent did not homer with a corked bat. Coda, corking a bat doesn't do shit anyway.
Coda.
Josh, what's your Peter Gammons' friend?
So I want to thank Rocky Lum for posting this on the Hang Up and Listen Facebook page. and bring it to my attention. Stefan, listen to this clip and let me know if you have any idea what's being discussed.
He took 8 contested marks, I think, tonight, but a lot of those are when he's on the lead, you know, and we sort of spoke to our players about, listen, don't let him lead at the ball, play in front, but, you know, I thought they blocked for him really well. The kicks that they do are incredibly smart, those 3-quarter kicks, so they're hard to, for our backs to judge. You know, they came off tonight, those kicks. You know, he played a wonderful game. I thought he was BOG tonight, an American, BOG. He was a star tonight.
All right, I'm going to go with either Australian rules football or Sipak Tara.
Aussie rules.
Yes.
You got it. That was Damian Hardwick, nicknamed Dimma, the head coach of the Richmond Football Club of the Australian Football League. He was talking after his team had its 22-game winning streak snapped in the preliminary final of the Aussie Rules playoffs. They lost to upstart Collingwood. At the end, you heard him say that an American was B-O-G, meaning best on ground, meaning the best player on the field. And that player was Mason Cox, a 6'10" dude from Dallas who was formerly a basketball player at Oklahoma State. Let's listen to Cox's highlight reel from Collingwood's upset win over Richmond. He kicked 3 goals and had 8 contested marks. Both of those are apparently good things to have done.
Cox is the biggest man there. A couple jumped. He's marked not more than 30 metres.
So Adam Cox again. Oh, he's getting better.
Oh, he's
getting bigger and better.
He's staring at him.
Can he do it again? You betcha.
So a thing you can't see if you're listening to this, because podcasting is an auditory medium, is that this guy Mason Cox is towering over everyone else on the field, which seems a little unfair, but it's not illegal to be tall. Anyway, tall guys have not really been a thing in Aussie rules football, which is a sport that involves catching and tackling and kicking. It's also the sport where when you kick the ball through the things, the ref does the finger guns, mm-hmm. Right, Stefan?
Right, I love that.
It's mostly known in my household as the sport where the ref does the finger guns. But tall guys are now apparently a thing in Aussie rules because Mason Cox went to a tryout camp in California after he was done playing basketball at Oklahoma State. And I should say that Cox did not have a storied college hoops career. He actually started out as a practice player for the women's team. They wanted someone big to simulate Brittany Griner, who was then playing for Baylor. He then became a walk-on for the men's team, where he only got in a few games in his career. He got to a tryout camp because he was spotted by this guy, Jonathan Givney, who is an NBA draft scout. He now works for ESPN.com. Givney was contracted by Australia's AFL to find basketball players who were not good enough to play in the NBA, but who might be athletic enough to transition to Aussie rules football. So Cox had played soccer growing up. He knew how to kick a ball, if not an Aussie rules football. And he impressed enough that he got a contract with this team, Collingwood. In a first-person essay for the website Players' Voice, which is Australian for Players' Tribune, apparently, Cox said, "I used to be looked at as a project player, as this novelty who is only getting a game because he's an American. So I've had a bit of a point to prove. I'm not some guy who's going to come in for a year and you'll never hear about me again. My man has now been there for 3.5 years looking to get Australian citizenship. He was just named B-O-fucking-G. Thank you very much." They're going to be in the grand final this coming weekend of Australian rules football. He'll be defended by Tom Barris of the West Coast Eagles, who has this to say: because he's so tall and has such long arms, he can reach the ball at the highest point. Seems like good scouting. Mm-hmm. He's a quality player, and he might lack a little bit of consistency, as you do early on in your career. But he's shown everyone and silenced the critics that he's a real force to be reckoned with. Good on you, Mason Cox.
I'm totally on the Mason Cox bandwagon now.
You've been reading while I was talking?
Yeah. But you know what else?
What?
You know who one of Mason Cox's teammates is? 2010 name of the year, Steel Sidebottom.
There you go. I didn't realize he was on Collingwood.
He's a Magpie.
That is our show for today.
Career Magpie.
Career Magpie. The best kind of magpie to be. Our producer is Patrick Ford. We got additional production help this week from Danielle Hewitt. To listen to past shows and subscribe or just reach out, go to slate.com/hangup. You can email us at hangup@slate.com. For Stefan Fatsis, I'm Josh Levine. Remember Zelma Obeidi, and thanks for listening.